Welcome back to another episode of the My Life, Your Life Together podcast. It's Zach and Zach, as always, and today we're joined by Simon Rennie, who is, as you all know, we're just getting into having remote guests recently, and he is a remote guest from Australia. So he's, I think you're our first international guest, I'm pretty sure.
That's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
So, thanks for having me. It's exciting. I want to say g'day, mate. I feel like I always have to do that whenever I meet with somebody from overseas. But we do say that a lot. We do say that a lot, but g'day, I guess.
Well, listen, we'll take it. He's been doing an Australian accent all day, and I'm sitting here all day, I'm like, don't do it. So when I've done the intro on every episode today, so when he asked to kick things off, I was like, he's going to do it.
No, I'm not.
He's going to ask him about the future.
I want to hear it. Yeah.
Oh, I can't.
Oh, yes. Now that the pressure's on, you're going to crumble.
What was I was just thinking of all the, like, you know, the... Was it from The Office? The dingo baby.
Oh, yeah.
I was like,
It's very Simpsons of you, like the early day Simpsons. I remember that episode, actually, where they did an Australian episode, and that was one of the lines in it as well. And I think The Office, covered it off as well. So, no, it was all right. It was good.
Don't ask me to say any more because I won't be able to pull it off.
So... Simon is one of the guests that just responded to a Facebook post I had among the sea of outreach. We got to chatting, and you were fun to message back and forth. So I was like, all right, well, we could probably get on pretty well. And then just like as I clicked through like your website and asked about it, like one thing that I can't remember if it was the first message or the comment or something, you were talking men's mental health. And we've done episodes on anxiety, depression, and one thing, like I made a point, I was like, I really want to incorporate something about specifically men's mental health because there's very much a stigma about it. And I don't anticipate the whole episode being focused on that, but it was something that drew me to, you know, messaging you back and forth. You have your company. You have a lot of stuff that I want to cover and get out there. But we always like, tell us a little bit about you, you know, your background, born in Australia.
Yeah, okay. Born and raised in Australia. It's funny we're talking about accents because I did a podcast a little while ago, and the person who edited that podcast was very big on linguistics and accents as well. And they could pick out this very specific location in Australia that I came from as well.
Really?
So it was really interesting. And you don't really think too much about that in Australia. I guess we all feel like we sound the same. I guess it's probably might be similar to you guys over there.
Having like a southern accent or a northern. Yeah.
So we have I guess there are different nuances in our language, and maybe the southern accent might be the equivalent of our rural accent, our, you know, the guys in the outback and so forth, but everyone else seems to be very different. But then, it's just interesting that you said that, and that popped into mind. But yeah, I am from Australia. If we haven't already identified, I am from Australia. Grew up in a place called Adelaide, so that's in South Australia, so that's in Central Australia down the bottom. I haven't lived in Adelaide for, I don't know, since 2006. I've traveled around, been in our nation's capital for a little while. I've lived in Hobart, which is right down the southern tip of Australia on a little island called Tasmania. And now I live in a beautiful place called Queensland, so the subtropics, which is, you know, lots of surfing, lots of outdoorsy type lifestyle. And I live here with my family. So I've got a wife and two little ones. So I've got a four-year-old and an eight-year-old. No, seven-year-old. I just gave him an extra year, as a dad usually does. A seven-year-old, and we're just living the family life up here, and it's a really cool place to live. But mine is one of a men's mental health story, and these days I have a business called Mindful Men, where I do men's therapy essentially, and I take therapy out of the clinic because I know how stigmatizing and challenging that men's mental health discussions can be for guys. I mean, it took me 20 years to go and get help from mm-hmm. first symptom to first treatment. And so we take therapy out of a clinic and we go to the beach and go for a walk, or we go grab a coffee, or some guys just like to go for a drive. The younger ones like to play video games. So I use a lot of my lived experience, and then also, I guess, my learned experience as a social worker as well, to kind of find a different way to support men with their mental health. And it's something I'm really passionate about, but it comes, I guess, with a lot of lived experience, history, a lot of pain, personal pain, a lot of drinking to numb it all. But these days I'm really feel like I'm thriving instead of sort of just surviving. And that's the kind of the message I hope by the end of today that we've given some guys out there, that you can thrive even though you might be challenged with something. And it doesn't have to be mental health. It could be anything in life. We can move from that survival mindset to a thriving one.
That's awesome. So you mentioned a lot of what you do as far as mental health comes from your own personal experience. Tell us a little bit about that. You said it was 20 years from first symptom of mental health struggle to when you started seeking help. What was that in, like, childhood? Was that, so what was your upbringing like? Yeah. What was those early years?
Yeah, so growing up in the northern suburbs of Adelaide, so I like to put context. As a social worker, context is really important, and I think for any mm-hmm. therapist, context is important. So I grew up in the 80s. I'm an 80s baby. Grew up in the 80s, 90s, noughties. That was my time of growing up. And, you know, this is a time before internet and Netflix and all those mm-hmm. types of things. And so in those early days, you know, I had two older brothers, one younger brother. Sports mad family, so we like to play Australian rules football, athletics in the summer, basketball, soccer as well. We used to like, me and my little brother used to love watching WWE wrestling. I think it was WWF back then, or we actually didn't have that. We had WCW on our TV. So we loved that on the weekends, and you know what we'd watch on TV. In the evenings, my older brother would dictate and be like the Terminator, Die Hard, Rambo, all these hyper-masculine you know, shows. And I say this with reason, because what it does is it captures what a lot of boys and men grew up with in that period. It's we're influenced by how to be a boy and then to be a man by the environment around us. So for me, it was very masculine, a lot of, or you'd say mm-hmm. hyper-masculine or alpha male as well. You know, that went into the schoolyard as well. So I was a bit of a, I don't know if you could call me a jock, but if you could picture what my persona was in the schoolyard, it was because I was good at sport. And so I could do most sports. Netball was one sport I could not do, and I used to hate it when we do it in PE. But, any other sport I could pick up and run with, and I'd be really good at it. So people would look at me in that kind of persona.
What's netball?
Netball? Have you not heard of netball?
What's netball?
It's basketball, but without running around. So you get the ball, and it's traditionally played by females, women, and girls.
Oh, is that the thing with no backboard?
Yeah. It's just a pole for the thing, and you're not allowed to run. And this was my challenge, because I grew up playing basketball and football, where you run with the ball and you bounce and so forth. Netball, you grab the ball and you have to stop.
Okay.
In your tracks, and there's also this thing called no contact. So if you touch someone, it's contact. And it's kind of like a penalty against you.
Oh, wow.
Whereas me, the football player, would be bashing into people all over the place.
Body checking. It neutralized everything that you loved about sports.
It was my kryptonite. It was my kryptonite.
Okay.
It's the one sport I could not get. And I used to get furious when the teacher would say, we're playing netball today. Because I just couldn't I couldn't use my normal athletic prowess to dominate the court, right? So we had that in the schoolyard. We had that on the football field. So I remember, you know, if you got big hit on the football field, you brush it off, you get up and you keep going. Mm-hmm. Because if you showed any sort of signs of weakness, like maybe a tear, or maybe like you go, oh, that really hurts or whatever, you'd be the next target for the next big hit. So the opposition would see that and go, okay, we've got to get this guy again, and we're going to keep doing it all game. And that scared me, so I really just bottled everything up and pushed on. And even in the household, like, if, you know, Dad was pretty tough, he would say, you mm-hmm. know, don't show any, like, if he started crying, he would say, you know, suck it up or stop being a wuss or whatever. And
yeah.
Friends would do that as well. And I guess what I watched on TV showed me that to be a boy and man was to be tough. So, you know, think of the Terminator, someone, or Die Hard. It's the main hero is very hyper-masculine. He would walk through walls of fire or get shot with bullets or stabbed, but still keep going. And so from a young age, I'm like, okay, this is what it means to be a young bloke. And you got to suck it up and you got to be tough and you got to, you know, move forward. And so leading up to 8 years old, Mum would often say I'm a happy-go-lucky kid. So someone who was always joking, always smiling, nothing ever fazed him. And I loved that about me. It was so freeing. It was so cool to be like that. I drew into that, or I bought into that. But around 8 years old in the schoolyard, another student in the schoolyard who I didn't really know, I just knew of them. I walked past them and they were having a conversation, and I stopped for some reason in the conversation, and they said, Simon, if you stop using your voice for more than 1 minute, you're going to lose your voice forever. And so this was my entry into obsessive compulsive disorder. So what that is, for anyone who hasn't heard of that before, and there's a lot of misconceptions about OCD, it essentially starts with an obsessive thought or an intrusive thought. And for an OCD mind, you can't get rid of that thought. It goes round and round and around and around. And the only way to get rid of that is to perform a compulsive behavior or compulsion. And for me, when I heard that, you know, that if I don't use my voice for more than a minute, so the obsessive thought, it raised a lot of anxiety and stress. And I'm like, I started freaking out because, you know, what happens if this happy-go-lucky kid can't use his voice to joke around, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I started humming to myself. So every minute I'd check my voice would still work with a hum, and it would go like this, like that. And very quietly, and I did this for about a year and a half, and nobody ever picked up on it. So I think I did it really quietly. It was very internalized.
Yeah,
I'd be doing it at the desk, at the school desk next to someone, you know, like you guys are sitting next to each other. I could be humming all day. And, you know, at least nobody ever said to me, Simon, why are you doing that noise? And I was just constantly checking that my voice was, you know, still existing. And so this was the entry into my mental health journey. And like I said, I didn't know how to talk about it because I'd been brought up in an environment where boys don't talk about this type of stuff. Boys are meant to be tough. Boys are meant to be strong. I didn't have a role model, like either at home or at school or in the sports field, that would go into these deep conversations about what's going on internally for you, because, you know, it's more the opposite. If we start talking about what's going on, we'd be labeled as girly, as gay, as a wuss, as a sissy, all these things. And I didn't want that. Yeah. I just wanted to be me. And so, did this for about a year and a half. Eventually that stopped. I kind of just grew out of that. And definitely for me, OCD, I've grown out of various stages, but I'll go through the main ones over time. Around 13 years, Mum and Dad separated. So me and my little brother, we moved out with Mum. And so one thing to understand about the northern suburbs of Adelaide where I grew up, it was a bit of a tough place to grow up. I didn't feel safe. There was a lot of lower socioeconomic households. People were unemployed. There was people in trade and services style roles, manufacturing. So certainly not the wealthy part of town, if you could call it that. A lot of gang violence. In fact, my school was it wouldn't be abnormal to see someone with a weapon in their bag for either self-defense or because they're part of some, you know, they want to be gang members or whatever. And so I always felt unsafe. And so to go out with Mum and live with Mum in another part of that suburb or that part of town, it scared the hell out of me. And so I, all of a sudden also, I guess in that period of time, everyone had a man of the house. I'm not sure if that's still a thing these days, but it certainly felt like this need to be a man of the house. And I put that upon myself as a 13-year-old boy. And so where my OCD really ramped up here is every night to feel safe and secure, I would walk around the house and check every window was closed, every door was locked, all the curtains were drawn. So, for example, right behind you guys have a curtain that's half open a little bit in the middle. I would make sure that you couldn't, that opening in the middle of the curtain didn't exist. And so it would be fully closed. And the reason for that was so that there wasn't somebody on the outside, so this mysterious bad man that I had in my head, looking in to seeing, okay, what can I steal, or, you know, who's in there? Can I spy on them? Or can I break into this house, steal their stuff, kidnap the kids, or murder them?
Mm-hmm.
And so these were the obsessive thoughts going through my mind as I was,
as a 13-year-old.
As a 13-year-old trying to put myself to bed every single night. And so what would happen is, and this is, I guess, where the disorder part of OCD really comes in, is you know, you often hear people say, oh, I'm a little bit OCD, or you know, I'm OCD because I need to have everything neat and tidy, or whatever. OCD becomes a disorder when you're doing these obsessive, you have these obsessive thoughts and you're doing these compulsive behaviors. It's really distressing. It has a profound impact on your life. And there's a time limit to it as well. So you're doing it for a minimum of an hour a day. So it's not just about making your desk neat and tidy and that's it. Wow. It's actually like you're doing it for a long period. And so for me to lock up the house, you know, I'd go around and do the loop, and I'd do it in a very specific way. Like, it might start with the front door, front windows, and then progress through the house in different rooms. And then I'd go to bed and my brain would say, Simon, did you really forget to check that window? Was that curtain fully drawn? Because if you've missed that, there's a potential for this boogeyman, or whatever you want to call him, this bad man to be looking through. And so up I'd get and off I'd go again. And so it wouldn't just be that window. It would be the whole process all over again.
Do that whole loop again.
Yeah. And so I would do that. And then what added a bit, I guess, a bit of extra tension to that process was, I also developed an obsessive thought that if there was like an iron left on, or the stove was left on and something could catch fire, it was on me to check that stuff as well, because I also had this fear of us burning down, dying through a burned down, house in our sleep. Yeah. And so that was added to the checking of the doors and the windows and so forth. And so this would take me on average probably 3 to 4 hours every night as a 13-year-old.
Wow.
Wow. So, and again, nobody knew I was doing it. Mum and my little brother were asleep. In fact, Mum's deaf, so when she has her hearing aids out, she can't hear. So I'm walking around the house, checking things, touching things. And I'd do it, I guess, really quietly. I liked houses where there was carpet, because that way nobody could hear me walking around at nighttime doing this type of stuff. Because it dampens the sound of footsteps, whereas if you had tiles or hardwood floors or whatever, you'd hear me pacing around the house.
Hear you, yep.
So this is where it ramped up, and I was still that happy-go-lucky kid on the outside, but on the inside I was a shell of a person. I was really struggling. I couldn't control these thoughts. And as, the next couple of years went on, I found alcohol. Alcohol was something to be fun without my friends, and we'd have parties and I would have great nights. But over time, it became my coping mechanism. It became my way to slow my brain, slow my thoughts, and feel normal to some degree. Mm-hmm. For the hours that I'd be drinking, I wouldn't be checking anything. I wouldn't be thinking about this mysterious boogeyman. I would just be me.
And so it would kind of quiet those thoughts down and kind of
completely.
And so when you would drink, would it completely stop all those cycles?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh wow.
But what it did, and this didn't show up until my later years, into my adult years, when I had a professional career, is what it did is it created a new obsessive compulsive, performance, which is called pure O. So pure obsessions. And this is where the behaviors aren't overt. You can't see the behavior. So you can't see me walking around. And what it did, it was I'd have a big bender. It might be Friday night drinks after work. Everyone from work goes down to the local pub, has a few beers. I would take it to the next level. I would be that one who had too many beers and drink really fast and be dancing, having a lot of fun, because I love that feeling of just being free of my mind. But what it looked like to everyone was Simon's a complete mess. But everyone loved it. No one really said anything bad about it. I think maybe I was just a really good dancer. I don't know. But I'd drink and drink and drink to the point where I'm pretty much getting home absolutely plastered, pass out. I wake up the next morning, and this is where OCD will go, okay, you've had the night off. I'm back. We're ready to go. And it would create this loop of trying to reassure myself what I did the night before. So it would be thinking about, okay, what happened in the night? Did you offend someone? Did you upset someone? Did you do something that was going to get you in trouble with the boss on Monday, et cetera, et cetera? And it would go so fast. It would start off very slow, and then it would get faster and faster and faster. And so this is the compulsive part of OCD in pure O. It's just the rumination of thoughts that you just can't get out of your head. And it would cause me so much anxiety that I would sometimes be sick. Like I might vomit, might have diarrhea. I'd have, terrible gut pains. I would pace. I'd be sweating and stuff like that. That might also be the alcohol coming out of my system the day after. And I would be so stressed because I'd be worried that something I did at that night would have me in the manager's office on Monday getting in trouble. And I really feared getting in trouble. That was, I think, the thing. I feared getting in trouble. I feared what other people thought of me. I feared that, I wanted to be liked and everyone to like me. And in fact, I did this for a long time. Nobody, I never got pulled into the manager's office. In fact, managers would say, Simon, that was so fun. We're going to do this again in a month's time and we hope that you're there.
Yeah.
But, this plagued me. And this was actually, this particular part of my OCD was one of the reasons I eventually gave up alcohol when I turned 40 or so last year. So I've been sober since then. But it was one of the things that I used to hate about drinking but also like about drinking at the same time. And so I guess that spanned 30 years, 35 years. I guess there's a lot of other elements of OCD. One that comes to mind is my car. So when I learned to drive as a 16, 17-year-old, I got a car and my license, which is all really cool. But then also I feared, if I didn't have the handbrake, so maybe I parked at a shops or something or parked in a driveway. And if I didn't have that handbrake really on tight so that the obsessive thought was that that car would roll down and kill someone or it might smash into a house, cause chaos. And I think part of the fear also was I didn't have any money to fix that problem if it did happen. I didn't know about insurance and that my mum had insurance for the car and all this type of stuff. I just felt like I had to find $1 million from somewhere and pay for someone's
distress. Yeah.
Well, what happens if I killed someone because I didn't pull the handbrake up on the car? And so I would obsessively check the handbrake was on its tightest ever. And that could be, I could go to work at my first part-time job in the shops, park the car, go inside, work for 20 minutes. And then this obsessive thought would come into my mind, Simon, that handbrake's not on. And that car is rolling down a hill right now. Those car parks were on flat ground, but I had this thought that there was a slight incline and it was going to start rolling. So I'd have to leave. I'd have to run back to my car to check. In the middle of a work shift, or maybe when I got a bit older, even in the schoolyard, because we were driving to school at 18. And so, I might be in class and I was like, sorry, miss, I've got to go to the toilet. And then I wouldn't be going to the bathroom. I'd be going to see my car.
Running out to check on the car.
And so that form part of it, that's still a big one for me. And these are how the intricate things about OCD, how OCD has showed up in various ways. But as I said, it took me 20 years from that first symptom as an 8-year-old to essentially my wife saying, Simon, you've got to get whatever's going on under control. And I say whatever's going on because we didn't know what mental health was. Nobody really talked about mental health or mental health conditions. She saw me drinking a lot. And so I guess that was the sign, Simon, you need to go sort this drinking out. She saw me getting super anxious after the drinking on a Friday night. And she goes, Simon, you've got to go sort that out. For 2 years, I deflected and I said, I don't think the issue is me. I think, if you've got an issue, maybe you're going to need to go speak to someone, whoever that someone was. I was doing that man thing, the masculine thing. I'm okay. There's nothing wrong with me.
Oh, I was just going to ask, so you got married and that loop that you would do at night before bed, did that carry on into your adult life as well with checking all the doors and windows and everything as well?
Yeah. So I still do that today, but not for 3 to 4 hours. And so this is, again, before I said I kind of grew out of certain aspects and I think I'm growing out of that thing now. I feel safe and secure now because I've been on an 11, 12 year therapy journey. I'm on medication now, doing the work in myself to learn strategies. But with the OCD, that that help came a lot longer after I first went and spoke to someone. And so to take it back, she, you know, for 2 years she tried to get me to go and seek help. And then after a while she said, Simon, you've either got to get help or you've got to get out. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to get out. Like, you know, I love you and all this type of stuff. We weren't married at that time. We were together. We had our own house and our own dogs and all that type of stuff.
Yeah.
So we were starting family life. And so I went to the doctor at 28 and I said, look, I think I've got this mental health condition. And it just kind of came out. And it was really hard to, like, I choked on the words as they came out. Mm-hmm. And so she was great. She did a few tests, like questionnaires, and showed signs of something happening, of some psychological distress. And so referred me to a psychologist. I went there and did a few more tests, you know, questionnaires, which was really interesting because we did two. And she said, Simon, on one, you performed like as if you're like just the average person. You got some right, you got some not so right. On another, you're an absolute genius. But she said your IQ is through the roof. Huh. And what that was is because that particular task was a repetitive task. And I link that to this superhuman ability to have OCD. OCD is a repetitive thing. You've got to do things in like hours and in routine. You've got to I call these clean numbers. I have to do things 3, 5, 10, 20 times. It couldn't be any other number. It had to be in a certain number. So I think that I'm not a genius by any way at all. but I think that ability to show that kind of test result came because for my life I had been programmed. I'd programmed myself to be obsessive and to do things in rumination and cycles. And so that enabled me to do that. So I went there because I was feeling a bit off and I was drinking too much. But she said, Simon, okay, after all these tests that you've done, it's showing up that you have depression. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's okay. I figured that maybe. You got anxiety? Yeah. Okay, well, didn't really know about the anxiety, but I'll take that. And then she said, you've got obsessive compulsive disorder. I'm like, what's that? And so I didn't know what that was, and so we explored that a little bit. And this is where, like, looking back on that, and this was in 2012, looking back on that and the next 10 years, I wondered what went wrong. And a few things went wrong is, first, I expected to go into a psychologist and get healed straight away. I didn't expect to have to do any homework. I expected the medications to, you know, I expected to go on medication and that would heal me. That hasn't worked. You know, I'm still on medication. I've been on a lot of different medications, and what I've come to realize is that you have to find the right one for you. And I think I've found the right one for me, but there's still a lot of issues there. And then also all the psychologists, counselors, psychiatrists, social workers, you name it, that I've seen over the years, nobody ever wanted to tackle OCD.
Really?
Only ever wanted to tackle depression and my drinking and maybe the anxiety as well. And I think that's because no one really understands OCD. There's not a lot of specialist therapists who focus on OCD. And so what happened to this is a long story, so we are going over 30 years, but I'm getting towards the end, guys.
You're absolutely fine. We love it.
In 2020, I burnt out, right? So I'm fast forwarding to 2020. I experienced burnout. I'd never experienced that before. So to give that context, I'd been managing these mental health conditions. You know, not very well. I was still drinking. I was on my meds. I was at the gym at the time, so I was thinking I was being healthy because I was going to the gym and I was going to therapy and all that type of stuff. I was working in a high pressure work environment. So the job that I had at the time was in the public service. A lot of key performance indicators. It was very much like a production line of a white collar job. So I'd sit at a desk and do one task, and then the next one will be there, and the next one, and the next one. So there's very high pressure, and I'd been doing that for a couple of years, and it was getting to me. I was studying my master's degree of social work at the same time, so part-time study in the evenings, on the weekends. We had two kids under three, so we had a newborn in the house. We had a three-year-old. We had this thing called COVID happen. So we were
little thing called COVID.
So we were locked down Australia has some of the longest lockdowns in the world. Like, you know, we were in and out of lockdowns. Those lockdowns might last a couple of months. Could only go to the shops to get groceries, or we can go around our local area within 5 km of our house And I think for some time we could only walk in pairs or something like that, even if unless you had a family unit, so we could take the family around the park for a walk. But yeah, we couldn't get together in groups and so forth. So there was that happening as well. And that meant also I couldn't go to the gym. So that stopped and I basically capitulated and I burnt out. Everything was just became too hard. And this is where the OCD shined a light on perfectionism for me. So an OCD mind is someone that tries to have everything perfect or just right in order to feel safe, in order to feel like we're coping. And I felt like I couldn't hit that bar of perfectionism anymore. And so I was becoming more and more cynical at work, and it played out at work. I was on a Zoom call like this or similar to this, and you know, my boss was asking me, Simon, your workloads are getting a bit longer to finish, and what's going on? And you know, I'm getting questioned by like my manager above me, so like senior managers were starting to take note of what's going on with Simon, and that freaked me out. I'm like, I always wanted to be this people pleaser. I wanted everyone to like me. I didn't like getting in trouble at work. And so I felt like I was getting in trouble and I just burst out crying. This is the first time I've ever done that outside with, you know, with anybody. And that includes therapists outside of my wife. And so I burst out crying and I said, I think I'm burnt out and I can't keep doing this anymore. And I think back to that time and I was becoming very cynical at work. Work was taking longer to complete. I had brain fog all the time, which... Yeah. Even though I've had all these mental health conditions, I could deal with the brain fog. Like it didn't stop me. And in fact, I was a very high achiever. You could say I was high functioning through all of this. Like even though I was drinking for 25 years, never impacted anything. You know, I could still get on the next day. I wouldn't get hangovers. And in fact, the next day I'd wake up and I'd be fine, even though, you know, sank about 12 beers the night before.
Yeah.
So I couldn't do all these things. I burnt out and I ended up taking 3 to 4 months off of work. And during that process, I started to recover, worked with a social worker who understood burnout and so forth, which was really fantastic. Finding a therapist who actually got me for the first time, and instead of just had the textbook smarts, they actually had lived experience smarts as well. So this is awesome.
Yeah.
And through that recovery process, Mindful Men was born, essentially. I felt like I got so sick of living like this double life for I don't know, 30 years, I wore the mask very well. Like on the outside, nobody would know I had all these things going on. On the inside, I would be a complete shell of a person. And I felt like just taking off that mask. And I think COVID enabled me to do that. People were having discussions around mental health. And so the first time I went public with it and I said, look, I burnt out. I'm a man with mental health challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I also live with OCD and depression and anxiety, and I felt like I just wanted to share that with the world. And so I created an Instagram page for Mindful Men just with the aim of sharing it and trying to support other guys, you know, to talk about their mental health. And it's through Instagram that I found an OCD community, which I didn't think existed. I thought I was the only person in the world that had OCD. Like, and this is a lot of the people that have mental health conditions. They feel like they're so lonely and isolated. They're like, I'm the only one in the world who experiences this, and particularly OCD that nobody really talks about.
You know,
we think about mental health and we talk a lot about depression. We talk a lot about suicide and to a lesser degree, anxiety, but not so much something like obsessive compulsive disorder.
Right.
And so finding these people on Instagram that had OCD, I'm like, I suddenly don't feel so alone in the world. It's weird. Like these are people from all over the world all I did was follow their pages. I didn't connect with them on a DM. Like I didn't communicate with them. They just became part of who I was following on Instagram. And I noticed that they were talking about this thing called exposure response prevention or ERP as the gold treatment for OCD. And like, I've never heard of this. I've been going to therapy for 10 years or so, and not one therapist has talked about ERP or OCD, basically, aside from that first diagnosis right at the start at 28 years old. And I'm like, I'm going to look into this. And so I went back to my GP, my new GP up here on the Sunshine Coast, and I said, look, I want to try this thing called ERP. Have you heard about it? He goes, no, never heard about it. And this is a mental health GP. So this is a GP that focuses on men's mental health specifically.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I had to do some Googling and find ERP providers in Australia. because a lot of my Instagram feed was all, a lot of people from the US, and there's a big ERP movement over in the US, and maybe to a lesser degree in the UK as well, but not so much in Australia. And it so happens that down the road, there was a place called Anxiety Clinic or Anxiety House. So, and by they're not sponsoring me to plug their names, but but they were an OCD specialist provider. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even know this existed here on the Sunshine Coast. And so I booked myself in and, had to take 6 months to get in. I was on a wait list for 6 months. And that's the nature of mental health in Australia. There's long wait lists for a lot of psychologists and counsellors and social workers. But I'm so glad I did it, because when I did get in there, I could talk to someone who understood OCD, and I could finally get the right strategies to manage the OCD. And this is, and we talked a bit about, the checking of the house before, like, am I still doing it? The strategies I learned in this clinic enabled me to take control of that routine finally and put that to bed. And, instead of doing things over 4 or 5 hours, it might be a half an hour to an hour. And in some cases, I could potentially, when I'm feeling really good, I could potentially not even meet the diagnostic criteria for OCD because I'm not doing it for more than an hour a day.
Yeah.
I'm managing it so well at the moment. And this is a highlight for anyone who is experiencing OCD out there, is that you can get treatment and you can get better and you can kind of take control back over your life. And that's the same with any mental health condition. And so I was just so fortunate to find that in a roundabout way after creating an Instagram page for Mindful Men and finding this community, not feeling so alone and having the courage and excitement to go and do the work. And this is where I guess I started to really do the work on myself. I didn't just go in there expecting the therapist to heal me. Like, I actually took the homework home and I did the homework. And now as a therapist myself, I love it when a client says, oh, yeah, Simon, I did your homework. And there's a real reason behind it. It's but I get it when they don't do it as well, because I did the same thing for so long.
Right,
so it is a lot more manageable now. And I guess that also influenced me. Having that experience influenced me around the drinking, and having kids also experienced, that the kids put a spotlight on my drinking over the last couple of years and so forth. So, things are a lot better, and I take a lot of this lived experience and I put it together with my social work degree to support the guys that I work with in my own therapy clinic now and do it in a different way. I do it in a different way because I've been that guy on the couch. I've in a therapy room, and there's not many services that are around specifically for guys. Like, you go in there, they're very feminine, they're very soft, they're meant to be, they're very warm, and that's the idea of therapy. You want to go in there feeling calm, but a lot of guys have a disconnect with that. Like, guys still want to be seen as guys, and they don't want to feel like they're broken or anything like that. And so that's the reason why I do it as well, because I've felt uncomfortable in those offices or those clinic spaces. And the guys that come in and do it with me, like, I dress up in a t-shirt and shorts and it looks like I'm going for a run every session, because it just helps break down all those barriers for guys. And I wish I had that in my journey. It wasn't until I found lived experience therapists that could really highlight that therapy can be done in a different way that's non-judgmental, non-stigmatizing. It's not shameful. That's the story in a nutshell. And I haven't even touched on the alcohol, a lot of the alcohol stuff, but and the burnout stuff. But happy to unpack that wherever you want to unpack it.
That's a fantastic.
Incredible story.
Yeah, I'm curious. How did you see? I know you mentioned with your wife, it got to a point where she was like, you either need to go get help or get out. How have you seen it affect your family as a whole, especially with having kids and stuff? What were the challenges with that, with having a whole family and walking through and struggling with mental health?
It's been tug of war comes to mind. I don't know why tug of war just came to mind, but it is a lot of giving and then taking as well. And that's me taking. A lot of them giving and me taking. When I went to therapy that first time, it felt like, okay, cool, I've got this under control. We're going to work on this. But I didn't do the homework. I still kept drinking for a long time. Australia has a very big drinking culture. And, yeah. and so it was actually more normal for us to drink than it is for us to not drink. And so the idea of being sober never crossed my mind. I didn't want to do that because there was also a lot of stigma around people that don't drink in Australia and shame. You know, you get shamed. Like if you say you went to a barbecue or a pub and you say, I'm not drinking, I'm designated driver, people say, what's wrong with you? And
interesting.
I even did that as well for many years. And I think looking back at that, I think a lot of it was just me because I hadn't processed my mental health challenges in a very good way. I hadn't processed the drinking. I'd bought into that context that, you know, to be a boy and to be a man was to someone who sucked it up and drank. And we used to do that. Like guys, a lot of guys do that. They find solitude in the bottom of a beer bottle.
Yeah.
Or drugs or porn or gambling, food addiction, all the addictive things. They that's where they find their comfort. And so a lot of me was just pretending that I was still fine and not dealing with it. But when I had kids and kids came a few years later, I think they really shined a spotlight on there that I could not look away from. Like my wife would say it and I would just dismiss it. And I hate saying that I kind of dismissed my wife for so long and it's not great, but the kids really brought me back from, you know, keep going down that rabbit hole. And how that happened was, you know, they're very young. You know, when my son was about 5, my daughter was 2, you know, they would say, Daddy, are you drinking today? It's the weekend. And they would say it more and more often. I'm like, oh, I don't like that. I don't like my kids talking about beer and drinking. Like, they're too young. This was going through my mind.
Right.
And then, you know, and then whenever we'd go somewhere to a function, like, I remember at my son's 3rd or 4th birthday, I said to my wife, you know, are we drinking? Can I go get a six-pack of beer? And in my mind, I'm like, oh, it's a celebration. She's like, it's a 3-year-old's birthday. And I didn't have that connection. I'm like, okay, I just thought it was a party and everyone, you know, and drinking enabled me to relax because I can get a bit socially awkward, which is weird because I do podcasting all the time and I don't have any awkwardness when I do this.
Yeah.
But like at a function, like I get really awkward. And so I think that's more social anxiety or just don't know where to position myself. If you ever, there's a great, I don't know if you've seen Kath and Kim over there, but there's a big Australian sitcom like that we had for a long time. It takes on the Australian bogan persona. It's like that, it's kind of like a redneck version in Australia. We call them bogans. And there's this great picture of Kath and Kim of they're at a big family barbecue and you've got one side of the table all talking and having a great time. You've got another side of the table all talking and having a great time. And then you've got one of the main male characters who's sitting right in the middle. He doesn't know whether to turn left or right. He's out of the conversation. He's trying to inject himself. Can't. And he's just sitting there doing the awkward smile or the awkward chuckle here and there because he can't connect with either part of the party. And that was me a lot of the time. Like, I didn't know how to engage in the small chit-chat or the small talk. And unless I had alcohol, I could just insert myself in any conversation and take it from there. And so that was happening a lot for me. And then we'd go out to functions and my wife would always drive home and I'd say, are you driving home? Because I'm going to be drinking. And that's fine in itself. You know, a lot of people, that's quite a normal thing. But then the kids would start saying, Mummy, why are you driving? You never drive. Like, Daddy always drives. And then we'd have to have conversations in the car with my now, you know, 4-year-old daughter and say, oh, Daddy's been drinking tonight. He can't drive. So we're not allowed to drink and drive. And then this would happen every time we were in the car when I've been drinking.
Yeah.
In my gut, in the passenger seat in the front, I'm just like, I hate this conversation. Why are we having this conversation with my young kids? I don't want this. And so this was happening more and more frequently and I was starting to get these seeds in my mind going, I've got to start changing. It's not quite working. And even I was feeling more groggy as I got older, like towards my 40th, I was drinking, but I wasn't really enjoying it anymore. I was just doing it for the numbing and just to feel relaxed. And I knew it by then as well. I knew that I was actively doing it. To add a bit of other shame to it, I guess, is as a therapist, I would sit in clinic and I would tell my client, you've got to stop drinking. You've got to stop taking drugs. Well, you've got to slow that down. But I was doing the opposite. You know, it's like the dentist that never gets his teeth fixed, or it's like the gardener that never does his own garden. Like I was never doing my own stuff at home. And so there was a bit of shame there as a therapist in what I do. And I think that was being highlighted because I was having a lot of clients come to me with drinking issues or drug issues. And I was having these conversations quite regularly. And then at my 40th, this all came to a head, and I thought, you know, it's my 40th, it's a big occasion, I might get lots of gifts, like, or get some nice gifts for my 40th, and we had a lot of family and friends around. The gifts were all alcohol. It was all different craft beers and so forth. And historically, the younger version of me would be like, yes, it's a party, we're doing this, we're going to get drunk, and it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
The 40-year-old me at the end of the night broke down, and I said to my wife, why did I get all these gifts of alcohol? And she said, that's because that's the identity that people know you for, is someone who likes to drink.
Wow.
And that was the knife to the heart. And that was the moment I go, you know what? I don't want that identity anymore. And all these things that had happened over the last couple of years with the kids and me as a therapist and so forth, me coming to that realization that alcohol is a depressant and, you know, I'm on antidepressants, like that doesn't make sense anymore. It, for some reason, I ignored that for a long time. And so, yeah, at 40 in one day, so the day after my 40th, I packed all the beer out of the fridge, put it on in a box, gave it away, tipped it down the drain, and haven't drank since. I've had some non-alcoholic beers, which was its own little bit of a struggle. Like, I felt like I was cheating when I was having a non-alcoholic beer because it has beer in the name. But once I got over that and got over the shame. And it's interesting because when I started sharing it with some of my social circles now, other guys said to me, Simon, I've been doing the same for years. Like, welcome to the club. I'm like, oh, really? Oh. Like, I felt like there was this shame because I had been the guy in the pub who questioned my mates about them not drinking years ago.
Right.
And I felt like they were going to shame me, but they're like, no, like, there's more and more of us as we get older who are embracing the sober lifestyle. In fact, alcohol is getting so expensive here. You know, it's just, you know, smoking, you know, to buy cigarettes went through the roof, and I'm not a smoker, but alcohol was following that as well. And so it's becoming more and more expensive. I was spending, you know, $60 a week, you know, on alcohol, you know, buying a carton of beer, but I wouldn't be anywhere. I'd be just drinking on my couch, you know, watching the footy on the weekend.
Yeah.
And so that was also playing on my mind, but it was so relieving to hear other guys say, you know what, I'm sober too, and it's good. So, yeah, that's been a really cool, I guess, pathway out of that mental health struggle, you know, piece, because I feel like I've got a lot more clarity in my mind. Mm. The alcohol discussions with my kids have stopped, so they're not talking about beer anymore because they're not seeing Dad with beer anymore.
Yeah.
Now it's just soda water or mineral water, or they do see me with a non-alcoholic beer, and I say, well, you know, you can buy this in the grocery store, which, you know, I see that as an okay sign to drink. And I think I'm enjoying that as well. I can only have two of those and I'm done. Whereas before I'd have six beers and I'd be like, okay, where's the next six pack coming from?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was a big catalyst. And I thank my family for doing that, you know, as a long circle back to the family question, like that was me now. I'm now giving back to my family because I'm no longer taking that time. I'm no longer taking the little moment where my wife might say, you can have a beer, and really a beer for me was like three, four, or five beers at the minimum.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to be able to not have that grogginess feeling anymore. I mean, I never got the hangovers, but it's nice not to have that rumination from the Friday night drinks anymore. I can be fully present with my family on the weekends, in the weeknights. I can have one non-alcoholic beer and be okay with that. I can now be the designated driver and be okay with that. And I thank my wife and my kids for highlighting that, and particularly my kids. And whenever I talk about these discussions around mental health, alcohol and all that, I think about my son, and he turns 8 next year. He's not 8 this year, like I said at the start of the show. He's 8 next year, and that's when it all started for me. Like, I look at him and my wife says, you two are exactly the same.
Wow.
and that scares me because, you know, I know in a year's time, like, for me, way back when was when it all began. So I do a lot of this for him to highlight to him that he can talk about stuff and that Dad's a safe place to come to talk about stuff with.
That's awesome.
Just hope that I'm leading by example for him.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, that's really good. You know, I just to tag on to that point, like my father's been open about his struggles with I don't want to say just anxiety, but anxiety, had a pretty big just burnout life caught up, everything all in once, 1 year. And, you know, he started medicine, and he started therapy and stuff like that. And I mean, something I talked about on episodes before is I really started noticing anxiety in my life when I was 16, and it took until 28 to actually do something about it. And, you know, there wasn't even something that my parents weren't going to be supportive, because one, I know my dad had been through it. Two, they've always been accepting and, you know, really not condemning anything that like me or my brother did, really. As long as it was good morally and ethically, I'll say that. But yeah, it still took me 12 years. And I remember when I started telling people that I was, you know, on medication and starting therapy, they were like, was it really that bad? Like my best friends, my doctors were like, oh, I never noticed. And I was like, well, that's the point. You weren't supposed to notice.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was waking up in the middle of the night thinking I was having heart attacks or couldn't breathe, or like my mind felt like the rat or the mouse on the wheel that just wouldn't stop. And my PCP, for years I'd gone back and forth about like medicine and stuff, and finally like it all hit the fan, and I was like, okay, I want to start something. She was like, okay, we'll start something, but I want you to look into therapy too, because this isn't going to fix it. And I was like, okay, yeah. Well, I started the medicine. I had my 1 month check-in. She's like, you doing good? I was like, yeah, I'm doing good. She's like, all right. Did you find a therapist? I was like, no. She's like, I can't force you to do it, but I'm telling you. She's like, I've known her for a while. She's a great person. She's like, you're doing yourself a disservice. And I got hooked up with a therapist at a practice near my house that, you know, my cousin recommended. And when you were saying that, you know, clients come in, patients come in and not doing their homework, I was like, yeah, I remember my first homework assignment. I'm very like routine, structure. And if that's broken, I'm like, one of my first homework assignments was do something spontaneous. And I remember like, nope. Asking her, how do I plan to do something spontaneous? She was just like, wait for a friend that you trust to text you and ask you to do something that day. And then you have to say yes. And I was like, okay. And my friend, we had plans to go to like an indoor football game, arena football game here. And so we had our tickets and everything. And he turns to me, he's like, these seats suck. There's empty seats up there. Do you want to go take them? And I was like, oh crap. And so I was like, yeah, sure. And so we did it. And like for one quarter of the game, I was just sitting there with like chest tightness. I'm like, I'm not supposed to be here. And then next session I was talking with her and she's like, okay, it's not like you told people who were sitting in the seats to take a hike. They were open. The stadium was, you know, 20% full. You didn't break the rules. It's, you know, you didn't break the law. It's fine. She's like, how'd you feel? I was like, I felt miserable the entire time. Thank you very much. She's like, good. You'll get used to it.
It's interesting you say that, because for me, perfection, as I said before, perfectionism was a big thing for me, mm-hmm. trying to manage everything. And when I finally started to work on the OCD, one of the things the therapist said to me, one of my homework pieces was, you've got to do something that's imperfect. And you've got to, because I was always a rule follower, like you. Like, I would have done exactly the same. Like, I'm not moving from this seat. This is my seat. Like, this is the one I'm being designated to sit in. I'm not allowed to sit anywhere else.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, and so, like, for me, it was, like, embracing imperfection. And I was always early to things. And it's just weird. And this is going to sound terrible as a therapist and someone who's got a small business now, right? But I was always super early, like half an hour early, because I always feared being late for things. And mm-hmm. I think that was me trying to be this perfect person. But then as I've become a dad, and I'm also a mobile therapist as well, things just take time as a dad. Like, they take a lot longer than we expect. And then also being a mobile therapist, so being on the road a lot, like, I can't control things like traffic and running late and so forth. And so that's become part of my routine, where I'm allowing myself to be 2 to 3 to 5 minutes late, and sitting with that anxiety, I'm like, oh, I'm a terrible person because I'm late for this session. most of the time when I get there, the guys are crawling out of bed or whatever. They're not even up, or they're like, what's 5 minutes, you know? And that's teaching me that it's okay to be imperfect or to break the rules a little bit of a client-therapist relationship. But it also supports my guys to recognize that if someone doesn't rock up on time, that they can sit with that anxiety as well and be okay with that as well. And so it's kind of I use it as a dual learning tool, but it's funny how these little homework tasks happen, and that one I certainly resonate with. And being imperfect has become part of my practice framework. So it's called this concept called wabi-sabi. It's the beauty in imperfection. And so I'm really embracing that now as a therapist and a small business owner, and even as a person. It's like, it's okay that I'm not perfect. I don't need to be this perfect person that I've tried to be for so long. I can be just me. I can be broken in parts, and I can put myself back together and be a bit of a Mr. Potato Head. Some days my ears hanging, you know, is my arm and all that type of stuff. Like, I can do that, and it's okay. And I think in the mental health discussion, in the mental health world, I guess we could say we feel like we're broken and that we can't be put back together, but we can. Like, it's just about doing the homework. It's about finding what works for you. Like, therapy or medication or whatever might not be your jam, but it could be surfing, or it could be equine, you know, working with horses, or art. A lot of people do art and creative things because it helps you focus in on one thing as opposed to all the 5 million things that are going through your mind as well. And so just finding what works is really useful. And this is also why therapists say, how's your self-care going? Are you exercising? How's your diet? Are you getting enough sunlight? Are you connecting with other people? Are you engaging with other people? Loneliness is apparently the next epidemic as well, particularly for men. Are you getting enough sleep, quality sleep as well? And so these are all really important, because if we're not getting those basics right, then of course we're going to be a bit out of whack on the side. It's like putting, you know, 3 tires on your car instead of 4, you know. Of course, if you're not, or you're putting
not going to work very well.
A gumboot on one of them as your tire. Like, if you're not addressing the basics, then you're not going to be able to move about in life, whether it's physically or mental, mentally, in a good, coherent way. And so basics work, but then also, doing the work as well. But depending on what that work is, you've got to find something and a therapist also that you can engage with.
Right.
So I had a question for you, because I don't know. So, excuse me. My background is law enforcement. I worked in law enforcement for 10 years, 4 years as private armed security, 6 years as a police officer. And I definitely understand that stigma of the, like, suck it up, you know, don't show weakness. You know, it makes me think of, like, if we went on calls that you saw some sort of horrifying, you know, traumatic thing, or you got injured, or, you know, shot at, whatever it was, right? They luckily now departments are getting better to where they offer mental health help. But among the officers, among your peers, it's still this stigma of, like, oh yeah, that guy had to go see the counselor, you know, or, you know, if you're, you know, sergeant or any of your command staff came up to be like, hey, are you good? Do you need help after this call or that call? Like, the automatic response is always like, nope, I'm good. Like, I'm good, Sarge. I'm, you know, and you know, there's basically all the things you've shared is kind of the same process, the same stigma that, you know, I've seen and experienced. How did you get yourself, you know, you mentioned that when you went to the doctor for the first time, you kind of had to, like, fight and choke the words out. What would you say to men that are struggling with mental health? Like, how do you get them to a place where they can open up about what they're struggling with?
Yeah, this is the most common question I get. Every week I get a call from a wife, a partner, a sister, a daughter, a mum, saying, I've got a guy in my life. How do I get them in to see you? And I said, I often say, like, this is going to suck, but you can't get them. You can't force them. Yep. So for any guys listening, it's more of a, they've got to have that light bulb moment themselves. So for me, it was after 2 years of my wife, my now wife, saying, you've got to go get help. It was that realization, if I don't finally get help, she's going to kick me out and I'm out.
Yeah.
That was my light bulb moment to go, you know what? I've got to deal with this right now. And so that's the first part, is knowing in yourself that there's something not quite working, that's not quite gelling in the way that you would like, or that you're not showing up in a way. Maybe you don't recognize that there's a mental health issue. Maybe you're just like super tired and super grumpy all the time, or you're pessimistic. Or maybe you're noticing that you're drinking too much, or you're taking drugs, or you're taking risks a lot more than you used to. Maybe because you're trying to find this feeling of being alive, or maybe you're just feeling lonely. Like, noticing what's going on internally for you, and having that moment going, you know what, if Simon and Zach can have a conversation for an hour about mental health, maybe I can go do the same as well. Like, recognizing that guys are doing this now, and it's an okay thing. But in a lot of environments, as you said, like even in that law enforcement environment, I've had that through my public service career as well. I had 15 years in the public service. Whether it's at schoolyard or on the sports field, no matter where it is, these are still things that guys are struggling with at the moment, is the fear of what other people are going to say, or not knowing how to do it. And so, first is the recognition that, you know, you might need help. The second is what I'd do is find someone, and that doesn't have to be a medical professional or therapist. It could be just your best mate or someone in your family who maybe has a good head on their shoulders, is someone who's not going to just talk you down and say, well, you know what, you know, don't be silly or don't be so soft or whatever. Like, someone who is capable of a deeper conversation, and maybe just broach the conversation there. Like, what do you think about mental health or whatever? Or you can do it in a roundabout way by maybe like listening to a podcast about mental health, and you can use my podcast, the Mindful Men podcast, if you want to do that, or your podcast, you know, this episode, and say, what do you think about that episode? Or did you see that news article or that media thing? Sports is a big one at the moment. There's a lot of sportsmen and sportswomen around the world taking mental health breaks.
Yeah.
So you could just say, you know, if they're into sport, you say, oh, what do you think about that player doing that or that coach doing that? Start the conversation in a roundabout way. If that's not going to work for you, because we don't always have that person. I never had that person growing up. So my next go-to was, you know, my wife could have done that to a little bit. And I guess we were having those conversations initially, but I really needed the proper professional help. And so what I'd do there is maybe look at who your GP is, or your general practitioner, your doctor that you go to for everything. Just have a bit of a reflection, and maybe you could broach it with them and see how they go. But a lot of people see generalist GPs. They're GPs that do everything under the sun. They're not so much ones that specialize in mental health, and particularly men's mental health. And so it's good to maybe go on to wherever your doctor is, if they've got a website, and look at the bios for all the doctors that are in that practice and go, okay. Because in their bios, they will say, this is my interest and my areas of interest. And I'm fortunate that I've got one up here now, where I live, who's interested in men's mental health. And so I'm like, okay, cool. I can go to him knowing that I'm going to get some good help, quality help there. I've also got a generalist GP that when I talk about mental health, I think he is out of it's not of his interest. So he just brushes me off a little bit faster than the other guy who will book a double appointment and will go through things slowly and stuff like that. And so maybe looking at that with your GP, is my GP a mental health specialist or has an interest in mental health? Because that goes a long way to what kind of treatment you're going to need to get. Are they just going to throw meds at you, or are they actually going to talk about some strategies or link you in with a therapist and so forth? So that's the next part. And then the next part is, if you're actually getting to the stage of a therapist, is do exactly the same. So for me, like trying to tackle OCD, we talked about that today. So for me to do that, I had to find a therapist who specialized in OCD. Maybe if your GP or your initial therapist says that you've got depression, you want to talk to someone who specializes in depression, as opposed, you know, if you're a man, you want to see a therapist or a doctor that specializes in men's health or men's mental health, as opposed to a pediatric therapist, you know, that's for kids.
Right.
or for women. But also knowing, do you feel more comfortable talking to a man or a woman?
Mm-hmm,
yeah. That's really important as well. My first few therapists were all women because I felt like I needed that mother kind of response.
Yeah.
I've since come to discover some really cool guys working in this space that I can, you know, go to. And this is important because I'm a therapist in therapy as well. So even though I'm a therapist, mm-hmm. I can't do my own therapy on myself.
Right.
It's good for me to have my own support networks as well. And so I go to these websites and I go, okay, who's, you know, good at OCD or who's good at burnout when I burnt out? Or if I'm struggling mm-hmm. with alcohol, it's who's good at alcohol and addiction? Like I'm really yeah. targeting these types of therapists because they've got a lot of the knowledge and they've got the experience and they might even have lived experience. So now I also kind of look for lived experience therapists, people just like me who have not only walked the walk, but they've, you know, done the books as well. You know, they've got the theories behind it as well. And as we said before, it's finding what works for you. So you could try it and you could drastically fail. Your first therapist might be a terrible discussion where they give you homework that you're like, I'm never doing that homework. So it might take you 4 or 5 different therapists to go, okay, now I know I'm talking to Joe here and Joe's amazing and we click.
Yeah.
It's the same with medication as well. You might be put on the medication and it just doesn't work. There's a lot of side effects with different medications. I won't rattle them off because it might scare a few guys away from going on medications. But also medication is not the answer as well. You know, it could be something different. Your self-care, is there another type of different therapy? We talked about art. Equine therapy, surf therapy is a new one that I've found, and I'm loving that because I've taken up surfing. So
that's awesome.
Finding that what works for you, realizing that there's so many options available, and if you get stuck, you know, you could just Google's great because it can help you work out what kind of works for you. But don't use it as Dr. Google and trying to fix you. Just try to use it as an information source. Where to point you to.
That's awesome. I like a lot of what you say, because I feel like most men most people in general, when they think therapy, right, they think the typical like Hollywood, okay, I'm lying on the couch and there's a guy there in a suit scribbling on a, you know, a notepad. But I like what you were pointing out with, you know, like you mentioned surf therapy, equine therapy, that stuff I haven't really heard of much before, but that sounds awesome because for myself, I love the outdoors. Like, I would much rather go out into the woods than I would sit in an office and, you know, talk. Like, I can imagine I would have much better conversations going like for a hike in the woods than I would sitting on a couch, you know.
It's more natural for us, you know, we've got to do what's natural, and even then, like. We're seeing a bit of a growth in the men's circle and the men's group space as well. So you don't have to go do one-to-one work. You could go on a men's retreat. And that sounds really wanky. I'm going to use the word wanky. Like for guys that are hyper-masculine, like, oh, that sounds a bit wanky. But it's actually really cool. Like I've been to a one-day retreat here on the Sunshine Coast and I thought I'd never do that. I'm like, I don't want to sit around with other guys and talk about our deep meaningfuls. It just seems unnatural for us.
Yeah,
but I went there and then we had a breath work session, which is a relatively new thing for me. So breath work. We didn't do any cold exposure, so the cold plunge. There's like a lot of people doing ice baths at the moment, and that's a good mental reset and physical reset as well. So it's not just good for the athletes, you know, on recovery.
Yeah.
It actually kind of shocks the body into better mental health as well. It's a really good
interesting.
But we did breath work. We did some journaling and self-reflection. I'm actually going deep into what masculinity is. And right at the start, I talked about, you know, context and growing up in where I grew up.
Yeah.
And I highlighted things around, you know, what we watched on TV and sports and all that type of stuff. And this all helps us define what it means to be a boy and a man. So this is does it mean to be masculine? You hear a lot about toxic masculinity in social media and the news at the moment, but what's healthy masculinity? It's guys talking. It's guys being with each other. It's guys being outdoors. It's, you know, guys helping each other, being fathers, being father-like figures, being brothers.
Yeah.
What is healthy masculinity? And so in that, we also went into a drumming circle and got creative. And I'm not a drummer. I'm a guitar player. But, you know, it was just nice to smash some bongos around for an hour in front of a fire.
That's awesome.
So, and then we had the fire pit as well. And so
Yeah.
Men's retreats, men's circles, men's groups can also bring out a lot of this type of stuff, because you can start having some genuine, authentic and vulnerable conversations compared to just going down to the pub with your mates, sinking a few beers and keeping it very superficial. Like that used to be traditionally, that used to be my go-to to be well and manage my mental health, to blow off steam. Or, you know, when I was a bit more athletic in my younger days, it would be playing football. It's blowing off steam. It's going to the gym and just thrashing it out. But I never really dealt with what's going on inside my mind. It's just that the body stuff. Let's say maybe a men's retreat or a men's circle or a social thing that where guys are getting together. And that could be sport as well, where you're getting together, you're creating good bonds, but they go deeper than the superficial conversation that we're used to having. Some guys find it in church and religion and spirituality. I say my spirituality is mindfulness. So I like to connect with guys that are interested in mindfulness and talk about, you know, just a bit of those masculinity things, about mental health, about fatherhood in 2024 and beyond, and so forth. And so, again, it's horses for courses. It's not just, as you said, sitting on a therapy couch, crying and feeling broken and all that. Like, it can be, there's a lot of that going on, but it doesn't have to be. There are practitioners like myself who throw away all that and just get to nature, because it's so grounding in itself.
That's awesome. So one of the things I'm interested in your story, because it sounds like it was later on that you went and got your master's in social work. Was that because of your mental health journey that made you want to go and do that?
Yeah, it's a bit of so growing up and coming into the end of high school, you know, everyone starts going, what's your career path? And like, I don't know, like northern suburbs of Adelaide, most of my friends actually left school early and they went into the manufacturing industry. So there was a car manufacturing plant near us where they built Holden's cars, which I think is GM over there, General Motors. And they went there because it was easy money. They'd do shift work. They'd be on $50,000 to $60,000, you know, as an 18-year-old. And like, that was the average. That was actually a pretty good wage back at the end of the 90s. And so I never wanted to do that. Other guys would go to trades. Other guys would just leave school and be on unemployment and just do drugs and gang life and all that kind of stuff. I didn't have anyone who'd been to university. In fact, it was very rare for, you know, someone in my social circles to go to university. A few of us did. I failed year 12. My mental health spiraled into really dark depression after a relationship breakup. My first real girlfriend, you know, she cheated on me and I went in a dark spiral and I left school in year 12. But I fortunately went back and did year 13 and repeated year 12, got into university. But at the time, I didn't know what mental health was. I knew I wanted to help people like me, and I said this to myself, I want to help people like me. I didn't know what a mental health career looked like or what it was, and so didn't get there. And so I ended up doing a generalist degree, did a social science degree with a major in anthropology. And at the time when I finished that, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew I wanted an office job because that's what I thought was good and was going to get me good money. And Google wasn't around back then. It was like we had Yahoo at the time. I think that was our search engine. I think AOL was another one that Australians used a little bit. And so I just typed into that, what does a social scientist do with an anthropology major? And the only thing that came up was a public service, you know, graduate career job. So I somehow applied and got one of those jobs, which was unusual in itself. And so did that for, I think I had a 15-year in a public service career and in different government agencies around Australia. Halfway through that, I was feeling unfulfilled. It wasn't a job that lit me up. I had some good jobs. So I had jobs in sports anti-doping, so protecting, as you know, the credibility of Australian professional athletes through drug testing. I worked in Border Force, so Australian Border Force, so you know, around immigration and border protection as well. I've been in our refugee detention centres, or should I say immigration detention centres. So similar to that law enforcement from a more of a border perspective. My last 4 years was in disability, so that's where I was kind of where I got the interest in disability, and I do a lot of work in disability now as a therapist. But about halfway through that career, these were all cool jobs and I got good money for it, but it never had me jumping out of bed in the morning to do a podcast, talk about mental health or whatever it was. So by then, halfway through the career, I knew I had the words mental health in my vocabulary. I knew what a mental health career looked like. And I said, I kind of want to go and study again and change careers and eventually start my own business, because I always wanted to have my own business. And so social work jumped out at me because it was creative. It wasn't something that I'd be sitting in a room all day. I could do whatever I wanted to do. And if I got bored of mental health, I can go work in child protection. I can work in aged care. I could work in a hospital. I could do a whole range of different types of jobs. Whereas if I did psychology or counseling, that might be a bit more pigeonholed and I'd have to be sitting, you know, very structured and routine-like or regimented in the way that it was delivered. And so that's why I found social work and that's why I chose it. And all the things that have happened in my life, including the mental health struggles, the alcohol stuff, the burnout in 2020, I think all led me towards finding this new career path as a social worker in private practice to support men with their mental health. And I think it's really now my life's passion and the thing that makes me thrive is talking about it and helping other guys to talk about it as well.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't. You looked like you had a question there for a second. I didn't
no,
know.
No, you're, okay. You're good.
So, what if you had to put into words what you're hoping that people listening to this episode would take away from it? What would you hope that someone can grasp from this? And is it different whether it's like male or female, or is it kind of both the same as far as what you're hoping to communicate to people?
Yeah, it's both the same. I think, we've focused on men, but I know women experience the same, or even non-binary people experience the same as well. Like it doesn't discriminate mental health. It doesn't matter who you are, what walk of life you're from, what your job is, what your race is, what your sexuality is, what your religion is. Doesn't discriminate. And I think for anybody, and particularly for guys, I love this saying, we say it a lot here in Australia, it's not weak to speak. In fact, it's actually quite, it's a sign of strength, that being vulnerable is cool these days. Like, you know, it's nice to be that, and it's so freeing. So I like to say it's not weak to speak, and that doesn't matter who you are, what gender you are, because I know a lot of people just in general struggle to talk about. They feel like it's a weakness if they do share about their mental health. And so I like to start off with that one, but also one that really resonates with me. Well, there's a couple. There's one is nothing changes if nothing changes as well. So if you're stuck in the same cycle over and over again, unless you make change, it's going to keep going. Kind of like that Groundhog Day, you know, the movie itself. Same and same every day. But this one I really love. It's the last one I'll share with you. It's from Tony Robbins, and someone highlighted this to me during my social work studies, and I just loved it ever since. And it's, change happens when the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change. And so if we get to that point where we're just in pain because of that's that Groundhog Day is happening over and over again, that becomes too much, and then we start to change. We can have those little light bulb moments or you know, seeds. We can plant those seeds and water them, and they come into a beautiful flower and or whatever it is, and start to grow and start to move and make different decisions. Maybe it's giving up alcohol. Maybe it's changing your social circles. You know, maybe it's going and seeing a GP or just talking about your mental health in general. A lot of growth can happen once you start doing that, allowing that part of yourself to come out. And for many of us, we can take off the mask and say, this is me, this is my full me, this is the true me. It's not just what you see on the outside, it's also what you're getting on the inside as well. And that's where healing comes from. That's where growth comes from. That's where we can break out of our own cycles and just live this life that we've always wanted to. You know, I'm starting to rediscover that happy-go-lucky Simon again. You know, because I'm sharing these stories. I've been doing this for a few years now, and the first, you know, even podcasting, for example, my first podcast, when I released my podcast, the Mindful Men podcast, I think I did that first episode about 100 times because I was worried about what people were going to say, and I couldn't get my words out right. But now I've been on over, you know, I've got over 100 episodes of that. I've got been on over 100 episodes of other podcasts as well. So, you know, now it's quite easy for me to talk about, and now I talk about it so much that when I am struggling, I'm straight to the therapist and say, or straight to my GP and say, all right, I'm going down. I need to come back up again. Who can I tap into to get my mojo back? And so it becomes easier and easier the more we do it. So, yeah, hopefully one of those, you know, affirmations or sayings can resonate with somebody and they can reach out to whoever can help them or start their own journey today. And that would be an amazing thing to hear if somebody did that. And I'd love for them to connect with us either through your show or through my show and just say, hey, I love that episode. This resonated me for this reason. So
that's awesome. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we appreciate you so much, you know, taking time and sharing that with, you know, a tiny podcast from New York and the other side of the world, really. I mean, I joined the Mindful Men Facebook group.
Yes.
And haven't, I mean, comment a little bit here and there. I haven't made a full post, but it's like, it's so cool what you're doing and just, you know, the impact you're having on people's everyday lives. You know, it doesn't have to be all big changes all at once. Like this, like you just said, you know, you're really good, but sometimes there's a spiral and you got to know who to reach out to and tap into where you go to, you know, your therapist or your GP. Now you have this network of men who are supporting each other, who can maybe even, you know, tap into before you get to that spiral and have to, you know, go to, you know, one of your doctors or something like that. So it's really cool. I'm looking forward to staying connected with you through that. And just stay in touch with you in general. I mean, it was such a nice time having you on and sharing all that with us. It was amazing.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. I think we just highlighted how easy it is to talk about mental health, you know.
Yeah.
People that don't know each other from the opposite ends of the world can sit down for over an hour now and talk about mental health. It is that easy, and it gets easy with time. So really have appreciated you bringing me on your show and sharing my insights and having a bit of, you know, jokes as well. You know, mental health is doesn't have to be all deep and serious. It can be, you know, lighthearted as well. So, thanks so much for having me on your show.
One more thing, Simon, if people want to get connected with you or get connected with the work you do, where can people find you?
Yeah, so they've got the website. So it's www.mindful-men.com.au. That links to also my therapy business, which is mainly in Australia, but it also links to my social media, which I do. The Mindful Men community, which is a Facebook community, which is for free. You can join that. But also the Mindful Men podcast as well, which is stories just like this every single week, hoping to inspire guys out there and girls and whoever listening out there to take, you know, mindful and meaningful action in their lives. So, yeah, touch base with me anywhere in there. If you're listening to this episode, make sure you share it to your socials or whatever and DM me, tag me and all that so I can share it amongst my followers as well. But yeah, again, really appreciate coming on.
Yeah, definitely will. And I'll include the links to your website and things like that in the description stuff because, I mean, you're a resource, you know. And
yeah,
a very good and intelligent resource. So thank you again. You know, have a good rest of your Sunday and we'll have a good rest of our Saturday.
Thanks.
All right. Take care.